The money pay all. Here we go.
In the course of time, there has been a great change in our ideas about the nature of the human soul. And in order to have some perspective on the modern attitude, we shall try to trace back to the original concepts and follow down through the principal modifications which have changed our attitudes toward this mysterious part of ourselves. The ancients believed that man's body was a kind of house or receptacle, and that at birth a living being entered into this house. This being was not created with the house, but had a life and existence of its own, a life which it could live apart and separate from body. Also, that this life existed prior to the creation of body and would survive it and would live on after the death of its physical house. This led to the concept that there was a difference in value between the outer or physical part of man and the invisible or psychic part. The body was less important because actually it was only a means of communication between an inner principle and the world in which man materially exists. Just as a person, if he found his house was on fire, would run out and save his life rather than perish with the house, so life became more important than any house that it inhabited. And the emphasis was upon the possibility of cultivating and improving the inner life of the individual through material existence or experience. This belief that man lived through a body or in a body, but was not a body primarily, has, of course, contributed a great deal to our ethics, to our morality, and to our spiritual approach to living. If this being in the body was the real person, then naturally this being within should control the body, and the psychic nature should dominate the material nature in all matters of importance and leadership. However, as time went on, it became more or less obvious that the psychic nature was a mixed blessing, that from within man there can come impulses that are as negative and as materialistic as those of the body. Actually, materialism is not a material or physical thing. It is a state of the soul. Because unless the person in the body held materialistic attitudes, the compound of soul and body could not be called materialistic. By degrees, therefore, also, it came to the conviction of ancient thinkers that practically everything that we regard as physical has its source and foundation in a psychological state. This does not mean that physical conditions have no existence, but it means that our interpretation of them what we do about them, and the kind of a world we build because of them. These are all strongly psychological. That the grass should be green and the sun should shine and the rain should fall, these are facts. But this civilization that man has built, this strange involved way of life, these customs, traditions, policies, attitudes, our economic theories, our political theories, all these things are not part of nature. They are not part of the great universal diffusion in which we exist. They are not imposed upon us by the dictatorship of space. All these great institutional motions come from within ourselves. Therefore, the fact that we pay rent, and the fact that we like certain kind of furniture or wear certain kind of clothing, all this is due to our psychic nature and not to what we term inevitable realities. Now, we may say that without some kind of psychic pressure, man would have remained a savage forever. That might be true. But, of course, there is no creature without some kind of psychic pressure. It follows necessarily that the kind of pressure that is exercised by the inner life tells us the direction in which large motions of society will trend, and also the directions in which personal character will be gradually intensified and matured, or modified and changed, if our own attitudes are amended. Thus, to the original idea that the soul was a living being moving into a body, there came modifications. What kind of a being moved into body? In this there is still some uncertainty. It is obvious that we must judge, in the case of man, the nature of his soul by its attributes, by the qualifications which it manifests, by the way in which it acts. Now, if we are to judge, in the case of man, that the quality of his psychic nature is determined by the impulses and pressures which this nature exercises in his objective life, we must come to the conclusion that the human soul is far from perfect. That this psychic life of man is also a growing and maturing thing. That this psychic life is under the laws of evolution. In fact, that what we call evolution for man is very largely the growth of his psychic life, producing as a consequence the apparent changes in his bodily structure. The evolution of form is due to the evolution of life within form, for it is this life which stamps itself upon form and causes the body to gradually develop into the likeness of the psychic pressure behind it. So we now have the concept of the person in the body, the soul entity, not as a perfect and infallible deity, but as a fallible and imperfect creature, capable of temper fits and the nasty spells of disposition and the like, capable of being unreasonable and of being ignorant, and also of suffering from innumerable intensities of mind and emotion, which may lead to difficult or even tragic consequences. Still, however, we recognize this entity in the body only rationally. The soul exists because man finds it necessary to explain the mystery of his own subjective life. He knows there is something there. And so by the study of the attributes and manifestations of this thing that is there, he seeks to identify the nature of something which is exceedingly intangible. Gradually in this pattern of thinking also, the theological factors began to appear. The ancients believed, certainly many of them, including the Greeks, the early Latins, most of the Asiatic peoples, that in some way man was made alive by the presence of a spirit within him. And in Genesis it says that God breathed the breath of life into man. Man became a living being. Now this breath of life, this divine breath, the ancients usually regarded as a symbol of spirit. And the question arose, is the theological term spirit identical with the more or less philosophical term soul? It cannot be if we wish to be formal in our thinking. Because if the soul is the spirit of God in man, then we are confronted with a most embarrassing situation. The spirit of God in man can become sick, can be extremely unpleasant, can cultivate a variety of vices, can lead the individual to such intensities as hate, or extraordinary passion, or hysteria. Therefore, if the soul is identical with a divine being, then we have to assume that deity is too much like the old concept of the God of jealousies and hates. Nor can we assume that that which is bestowed by God could be wrong, or could be fallible, or could impel us ultimately to destructive action. Yet the soul may do any of these things. And the soul apparently is not capable by itself and of itself of its own spontaneous recognition of God. Therefore, we must question the possibility of the soul and the spirit being given the same general term. The Bible tells us also in one place that the soul that sinneth, it shall die. In another place it says that the spirit shall return to God who gave it. So I think we have to assume that by spirit we mean the primary and eternal life principle, that by which man becomes alive, a living thing, a living being, and that this spirit manifests most immediately through our experience as vitality, as the tremendous energy by which all other things are accomplished, and that the God in man is a very recondite thing, hidden, deeply removed from our immediate observation, and perhaps primarily responsible for the simple fact, I am. That is, I exist. Consequently, the soul has more to do not with existence, but as qualitative expression of attitudes and feelings. The soul seems, therefore, or the psychic self, seems to be the source and root of disposition, of natures and qualities. And from the soul, we gain a conditioned kind of life. And according to the Greeks, the soul itself consisted of three parts. One of these was termed the animal soul, which according to the Greeks, verged constantly toward identity with body, to become what we might term the appetitive soul, or the soul that is forever seeking satisfaction through gratification. This is the soul which we consider intensely personal and very often profoundly selfish. Then there was a second part of the soul, which was called the rational or human soul, that was seated in the middle distance between extremes. And this soul, focusing very largely through the mental-emotional complex, is the soul which causes the human being to be like a human being rather than like anything else. Therefore, it is the soul of the unique humanity in man, the soul by which he is neither God nor beast, but by which he progresses and advances those concerns most natural to his kind. Then the Greeks represented the third part of the soul as a divine being, a creature aspiring constantly through intuition and inspiration to union with the gods, a part of man's psychic life forever verging toward reality, and ever seeking to escape from the bondage of matter. And around these different parts of the soul, legends like Cupid and Psyche, fables of Eros, were created. And man gradually emerged as required by nature, as his primary objective, to conquer the mystery of his own soul. Thus the hero cycles came into existence, in which by means of a varied symbolism, this valid purpose was emphasized, that the first duty of each person is to solve the mystery of his soul. This is the strange challenge, perhaps concealed under the ancient term, man know thyself. In any event, it was philosophized, particularly in the great mystery institutions of India and Egypt and Persia, that the road to self-mastery, the road to godhood for man, must lead through the strange psychic fantasy of the soul. That no person, no being could approach reality except through the soul. And that the soul's victory over materiality and physical objectivity was an essential step towards the attainment of inner wisdom. Now, even at an early time, we can more or less rationalize the reason for this attitude. We only have to work with people for a very short time to realize that the average individual is his own worst enemy. That it will be almost impossible for us to be as badly treated by others as we treat ourselves, especially when we are trying to be exceptionally good to ourselves. We have never apparently achieved that rational attitude which is supposed to be so excellent in parents, namely that happy ground between spoiling by catering and indulgence and damaging through extra severity or lack of understanding. Our natural tendency with ourselves is always to be indulgent. If, however, we should develop a peculiar kind of religious fanaticism, we may begin a process of penance that is also equally damaging. Man is not a moderate creature. And between him and any state of security for himself, and any permanent state of security for his world, lies this psychic interval of uncontrolled excesses and intensities. This interval of unreasonable joys and ungrounded fears. This tendency to dramatize everything and to live in a strange half-dream, half-nightmare, made up of all of our false conclusions and immature reactions on thousands of subjects. So the average person is not only damaged by these intensities, but he is prevented by them from seeking the solution to his real problem. Between every person and the truth he sees is himself. He is inclined to think or believe that it's someone else or other conditions. But our ability to understand depends almost completely upon the integration of our own resources. And to the modern man, his psychic nature is not integrated. Now we sometimes also wonder whether the times we live in are working unusual hardships upon the psychic life of man. I think the answer lies in that more is demanded today of the psychic integrity of the individual than he has available. The purpose of the soul is to sustain man under stress. Yet to accomplish this end, the psychic life must certainly be brought under a rational discipline. It must be organized. It must be matured. It must be given real thought and consideration. It means, perhaps, then, that at this time we have made greater demands upon the psychic life than was previously so obvious. And these demands have revealed to us that in the last 100 years of civilization, we have made practically no effort to mature the inner parts of ourselves. We have advanced materially more rapidly than we have advanced psychologically, culturally, or philosophically.
Okay, so that's Manly P. Hall on the human soul. So here, taking what he's just said there, let's reinterpret the whole situation. So in terms of soul development and in terms of soul growth, the current situation is putting pressure on people. So it's putting pressure on people to try and solve a problem. I'm being broad and vague just because I want this to apply to other situations as well. So we've got an external problem that we're looking to solve that's putting pressure on people psychologically. So where do you look to solve the problem? Do you look to the outside or do you look to the inside? That's the question. That's my question anyway. And if you try and solve the problem on the outside, is that going to work? It might partly work. But solving the problem psychologically, in other words, one person at a time, starting with me, is that more likely to solve the problem or less likely? I don't know. But it's a place to start. And the only resistance I've got to whatever happens to me psychologically is coming from me. So I can solve those problems. whatever they are. And I've already kind of made the assumption that imagination creates reality because I've been working with that for the last couple of years. So that's an assumption that would suggest that the psychological approach is going to solve the problem more effectively. Manny P. Hall was talking, I don't know whether this is the 50s, the 60s, or the 70s, but it's quite a while ago, and it's not this specific situation, but it applies to every situation, pretty much. Because it's a good model of how things happen, in my view, anyway. So looking at my own personal psychology is the way that I solve problems. It has been for 20 something years. I called it healing. Now I don't really call it healing very much anymore, but and call it transmutation or transformation. But becoming whole, which is what healing is revealing wholeness. In this model, in Manly P. Hall's model, the spirit is whole, and the soul contains obstacles and resistance and misunderstandings and all of those things that are the process of development is to remove the obstacles, to clear the rubble, to remove any misunderstandings. We then align soul with spirit. So that's a model that I like and a model that I can work with. I don't know what else to say now, really. I pretty much covered what I wanted to say. So thanks for listening. I'm going to edit out all the silence and the first video that I played, hopefully, so that this becomes a standalone thing. But thanks for listening.